So it's difficult to know where to start. The first thing I want to say is that you may have begun to discern my understanding and attitude towards the relationship between science and theology, or the Bible, that it is obviously of a certain formation, and it needs perhaps to be slightly developed so that you can get the idea of where we're coming from. Throughout the history of, obviously, thinking Christians, not necessarily every man jack of us, because it wasn't a particular issue for thousands upon thousands of peasants, we might say, through the thousands, the 2,000 years of church history. But thinking Christians, people like Augustine and others, have always seen that the universe was not literally speaking just 7 days old in creation, but it was more ancient than that, and interpreted the days in some form of time concept, that they were a long period. And many thinking Christians that we've got records from, we've got to realize that we're dependent only on what's been left over to us from history, would have thought through that particular area of the age of the universe and how God actually formed the creation of man. People get the impression today, because of a sort of a cheap jack straw man that can easily be knocked down, that Christians have always thought very simplistically, therefore, and we believe that the universe was made in 7 days, and that somehow or other science was a great enemy of Christianity, and science has emancipated people from all the myths and the false views of religion. In actual fact, throughout the history of the church, and this is important, the way in which theology and science, how Christianity and scientific inquiry, how they went together, was like this. It's pretty obvious when you stop to think about it, only for a few minutes, but this has been through 2,000 years of church history until the end of the 19th century. And they understood it, and rightly so, as I would suggest. It might be put over by people like Francis Bacon and other thinkers in the period of the Reformation period. It may have been put over by Thomas Aquinas. It may have been put over by people like Augustine. But the idea was basically this. God has given us two books. And they're both his books. And you can't, in a sense, unless you define your categories, say one is more important than the other. You've got to say, for what? The first book was the universe. And of course we couldn't do without that book. If it wasn't there, then we wouldn't be here either. So there was the book of the universe. The book of the universe was investigated by the discipline which we call science. That as we weigh, measure, as we observe, we begin to develop science. So what is given, the data of the universe, the data, the given, what is given to us, the data, cannot be changed. That is God given. It is infallible. But the exercise of science, which is the investigation into that data, is not infallible. Data, the God-given, is fixed and infallible. Science, the inquiry into that data, is continuously growing and developing. And nobody here who studied science will have any problems with that, that science is always changing. It discards, it takes up new things, it gets deeper, and older views become redundant, and science is an ongoing exercise of humans. God writes the data, humans write science. Similarly, the second book of God is the Bible. God writes the Bible, inspiration and authority of Scripture and so on, the areas we look at more thoroughly as time goes on, no doubt. And God writes the Bible, and that is the data of theology. But the exercise of theology is man's occupation. Theology is not God-given. The scriptures are God-given. Theology is man's work on the data. So in exactly equivalent manner, as a scientist, the theologian is handling and dealing with that which is given. That which is given is infallible. That which is given is God's inspiration. That is true both of the universe and of the scriptures. That which is man's exercise is science and theology, and both of those change. They are variables. We don't know it all yet. You follow? So there should never be thought that there is a kind of a battle between science and theology. They are simply two disciplines of men based upon that which is given of God. And we were talking in the kitchen, and one of us was suggesting about the threat that sometimes occurs, that we ought not to feel any threat. We should have absolutely no threat whatsoever. And a good Christian who is a scientist knows very well there is no threat either to his discipline or to his faith. He is pursuing, and this is a part of faith, he's pursuing truth both in the realms of theology and in the realms of science. And if ever the two meet, they will always, in the end, concur. Now, you got it? That is the way in which Christians, over 2,000 years of church history, have looked at the universe, science, and of the Bible, and theology. That should be fairly satisfactory. But, unfortunately, we don't always sit comfortably with these well-worn positions. When Galileo came along, it has often been said that Galileo was opposed by the church, in this case the Catholic Church, and here was science trying to emancipate itself out of the stronghold of religion. And there was a controversy between Galileo and the cardinals, representative Bellarmine, who Cardinal Bellarmine, the Pope's representative, and they had this debate and arguments, and the books of Galileo were put on the index, that is, they're not fit to read. Now, of course, from time to time, the Catholic Church has been a bit heavy-handed, so has the Protestant, for that matter. It's just the Anabaptists and the radicals who believe in liberalism and freedom and give room for each other to inquire and not kill each other for it. But nonetheless, that was what is the popular view. I'm going to try and demolish that in a moment, because I think it's a completely incorrect view of history. However, that seemed to give some sort of credence to a debate or an argument or a fight, and that science and religion just don't mix. In actual fact, that is a heresy of the 19th century. It was promoted in a book whose name I could look up, and a man, it's all there in the record somewhere, but I can't remember every single bit of data these days, just off the drop of a hat, or off my cuff. But towards the end of the 19th century, for probably very, very bad reasons, an atheist writer tried to put up this great sort of contention between Christianity and science. Now, I need to urge you to understand, science as a discipline of inquiring into nature would not, and applying it, would not have existed if it had not been for the Christian ethos. Forget the Greeks for a minute, I'll come back to those. Scientific inquiry and all its technological advances and so-called improvements in the universe did not come out of Africa, it did not come out of Asia and China, it did not come out of even South America. It came out of the heart of Christendom. That isn't mean to say that I like Christendom, that's just simply, it came from a culture in which the view of the world was a, roughly speaking, biblical view of the world. And that is the first thing that to get into our computers. Don't let people try to put you down on this matter. There would be no such discipline as science today if there had not been a concept of the universe held in Europe that it was consistent because God was faithful and God was consistent. He was not like the Greek gods, always changing his mind. He was not like the relationship that the Greeks saw between God and the universe. God and the universe for the Greeks was that the universe was a kind of a wayward son of God, a prodigal son, always usurping and upsetting and having to be brought back into line. So you had no idea what might happen next. And the Greeks were like that. You say, but didn't they have scientists? Not real scientists, no. They had people who observed and made some geometrical calculations or jumped into baths and thought, oh, I wonder how much water's come out. Archimedes and so on. But for actual scientific discipline, understanding what it's doing and then applying it in technology, no, they weren't. They were nothing like the scientists that grew up in the Renaissance period, out of a background understanding that if we go to the universe, we can go and we can extrapolate from it laws and principles which will continue to be that way because God doesn't keep changing his mind overnight. The Greek gods could change their mind over gravity and it could work the other way around if they wanted to, just like that. But God wouldn't, because God is faithful and God is consistent. And God is one thing and not another. And therefore he is a consistent God and he keeps his promises. That is born out of the Christian view of the Old and the New Testaments. And it was that which permeated the society of Christendom. And it was out of that that great inquirers and those who began to develop the concepts of weighing and measuring, of observing, began to arise. And although we had great insight in the intuitive realm of, say, Ptolemy and the concept of the earth being on the move and so on, it had to wait until a more consistent view, and eventually how fast it begins to go, soon as that idea is recovered, it is absolute brilliance that somebody like Kepler could come up with the ellipsoid pattern and understand and give a formula to the way that the planets were moving. Now, Kepler was a Protestant, but was treated like a sacred cow. He was allowed to travel through Catholic countries and debate in Catholic universities and in Vienna and Prague and other places because Christians were not persecuting scientists. It's quite false to say that. Whether they were Protestants or Catholics, they were considered almost as sacred cows. Kepler had already come up with the elliptical movement of the planets around the sun before ever the fuss blew up about Galileo. And when Galileo might have been thought to unnecessarily be disturbing the ordinary European peasant's view that the earth seemed pretty solid and we stood on it and we weren't moving anywhere, and therefore he was being upset with that view, which masses of people, Christians and non-Christians, had anyway. Because he was thought to be upsetting it, Galileo was honourably detained for 4 days to have a disputation. He was not imprisoned, he was not tortured. These are all myths that have grown up and been promulgated by atheists for less than good purposes. He, in his honourable detention in the debate with Bellarmine, was a rather abrasive sort of man, not a particularly polite sort of guy, and obviously the Pope didn't like being drawn with a dunce's hat on and things like that, which Galileo was probably responsible for, or some of his friends anyway. And in this debate, the issue was, do we have enough evidence at the moment to upset the whole of Europe, who from their intuitive understanding of life stand on solid ground that doesn't move and start to say that we go around the sun, not the sun round us, when they can see the sun going round but they can't see us going anywhere. Do we need to upset everybody because have we shown that this is the truth of the matter? Years before, Copernicus, had begun to emphasize a heliocentric universe and tried to get the sun, the us going around the sun, heliocentric, sun-centered, to get us going around the sun in sort of circles, like taking a penny and a halfpenny and a shilling and what do you call it nowadays, 10p, and moving one on top of the other, and they kept moving and trying to get pathways to explain, of course, that we weren't actually like a circle, but it was a series of circles that could actually draw out this path. Copernicus had done this, and he was a canon of the Roman Catholic Church in Poland. And here's the church, in its concepts from the Bible, exercising its weighing and measuring disciplines of observation, and coming up with suggestions which did correspond with Ptolemy, and but ultimately was going to be wonderfully interpreted by Kepler, and they, who was Protestant, it's true. But Galileo tried to prove in the debate that the Earth goes round the sun. You're listening carefully. This is not the research only of Christians, it's the research of non-Christians who've written it all up, like Kepler. Couldn't be said to be biased towards Christians. But they've written up, and what he was trying to do was to demonstrate that the Earth went round the sun because primarily the evidence of the movement of the tides. Today, almost every school child knows that the movement of the tides, nothing to do with the sun, is to do with the moon. And so the science that he was using was not adequate. And that was the church's reaction to him. Why cause such an upset and a stir at this present stage of things when your science is not good enough yet? See the point? Before that, before Galileo was looking through his jolly telescope and so on, Kepler had already gone miles beyond this. And it was being accepted by scholars throughout Europe. And it's brilliant, of course. Who would have conceived of the of an ellipsoid, a kind of movement? And he had the formula for it, you know, that you're always sweeping out the same space between where the you know, what an ellipse is made up of, between the moving object and the central point. And that ellipsoid pattern was put into a formula. And we begin to see that the sun and all the planets are going around the Earth that way. And that was before Galileo was put on trial. So when people say the church, one, they mean the Catholic Church. Two, the Catholic Church being fairly reasonable, to be fair to it, when it's got the well-being of its adherents throughout Europe and in its viewpoint. And that already the work had been large, well, a lot of the work had already been done by a Catholic canon, Copernicus, over in Poland. It really is shows that there is a nasty streak somewhere that is trying to misuse history and to set up a false history, rewrite history, to attack the church or to attack Christianity. Now, that is exactly what happened in two books that came out towards the end of the 19th century. And the reaction to those two books at the end of the 19th century has largely been from a work of a man called Agassiz and another MacCready, who brought in a new view to try and counteract those attacks, saying that science and faith don't mix, that they're against one another. And they tried to bring in a view. Now listen carefully again. This time, instead of the age-old, as I believe, right view, that the two books sit alongside each other like that, they tried to answer these accusations of Christianity versus science by saying the Bible takes precedence over the universe. Now, when you stop to think about it for a few moments, it's ridiculous. The two books may have very different purposes, but you can't say one takes precedence over the other. If you've got a book on cookery and a book upon paleontology, they're two different areas, and you can't say one has precedence over the other. But that's what where the problem begins with the New Age people. They say the Bible is the Bible and its truth, and that's what God's given us. The universe, well, that is secondary, and we don't put the two books alongside each other so that we interpret them in order that they might agree and cohere, because it's the one and the same God, and the two books therefore won't disagree with each other. We interpret our science under the scriptures, and that the scriptures determine how we understand science. Now that is a new view. Christians never did that in the past. They began to do it in this reaction to the attack of atheists and others who were trying to mislead people to think that Christianity and science just don't mix. Science was born out of a worldview of a consistent God who consistently maintains it. That's how we can ever draw any conclusions from our observations. And that is a healthy, right and proper Christian exercise. The scriptures are the data God's given us to work on to try and understand theology. And the two viewpoints must be put together and interpreted together, not in opposition to one another. The scriptures don't take precedence over science, so any Christian who is a scientist has to subject his inquiries under the scriptures, because they're not given for that purpose. But he mustn't come up with conclusions to contradict scripture, and the scripture mustn't, theologians mustn't come up with answers to contradict the science. Unless, in that apparent contradiction that exists, we can get deeper and deeper into the mind of God. Because that's what happens in a dialectic, isn't it? You make an assertion, there is an anti, there's a thesis, there's an antithesis. There's an assertion, there's a contrary assertion. The two come into conflict, and there is a synthesis. And the synthesis brings us nearer to the truth. And that's how we ought to be using those two books. Not as one above another, but alongside each other to get deeper and deeper into the mind of God. Now, do you notice the subtle difference then in the way that we use the Bible? We don't use it saying the whole truth of the universe is subject to the Bible. We say the Bible will not contradict science, science will not contradict the Bible. And we work all the time for a coherence between the two. And then we know we're interpreting correctly. Are you still with me? If you can get that and understand it, you'll see why I'm not a new age, young earthist, and feel that one has to go along that kind of approach to interpret the scriptures. That we may have come up with things from either of them which are inaccurate, and that's why they're clashing. But you see, it isn't the Bible that's wrong or the universe that's wrong. It's our theology and our science that are wrong. And that's what has to change. Here's a general kind of interesting statement. Before I go on a little bit to Darwin, I think I'll take up a little bit of Darwin now, just to keep us all happy, having tried to justify Galileo, which a lot of people wouldn't particularly like. We'll have a look at a bit of Darwin and a few other scientists, maybe. But first of all, an atheist of about 40 years ago, Sir Arthur Keith, who was a non-Christian, wrote the preface for the 1928 edition of Darwin's Origin of Species. And in the Origin of Species 1928 edition, he writes in the preface this. He's not a Christian. He often attacked Christianity. There were often debates on the radio in those days, not the television. And he was often the proponent they would go for to put the atheist viewpoint. He says in the preface, and he commits himself in writing, "Evolution is unproved and unprovable." He means by that from a strictly scientific point of view, you cannot put evolution into a laboratory and observe it. Therefore, from a scientific point of view, it is strictly unprovable, because you can't weigh and measure it. You need a few billion years thrown into the experiment, and we're not there to pick up the results. So evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it. Notice believe. We believe it. I'm not saying we proved it. We believe it. Because the only alternative is special creation, which is unthinkable. Because he can't think of special creation, then it is not to be accepted. Now, I'm not saying that I'm dismissing evolution in all its forms and aspects. I'm just simply pointing out the irrelevance of a lot of the arguments and the debates that have gone on these issues. In the preface to the 56 and the 63 edition, because the centenary edition in 63 of Darwin's Origin of Species, Professor Thompson, again, no friend of Christianity, wrote, "The elusive character of the Darwinian argument, its very nature gives it a kind of immunity to disprove." Because it's so elusive, then the character of it's elusive, it makes it almost impossible to disprove it. And that's going from the other direction since the days of Karl Popper and people like that. If you want to prove something is wrong, you've got to deduce or invent an experiment which would demonstrate, not necessarily that it's right, but to demonstrate that it's wrong. Now, that's the way around that you work. You can demonstrate something's right many times, it doesn't prove it. If you can demonstrate it's wrong, then you've got rid of it, and that's the way you go for it. That's how you get to your assurance and your assertion. Well, you just can't get hold of evolution like this to do that to it. You can't invent an experiment to demonstrate that it's wrong. Therefore, we can never put it into the scientific test. So again, in the definition of scientific, we are very, very disadvantaged if it were right that evolution is a wicked tool of the devil to try and put down Christianity. It is such an elusive one, you can't get hold of it to show it's right or wrong. But I don't think, in the end, people who've thought these things through, atheists who've thought them through, know very well, as these statements make clear, that that is the state of play. And therefore, in a way, we're a little bit wasting our time arguing, do you believe in evolution, pollution, convolution, or devolution, or whatever. We ought to have dropped the thing as a red herring most of the time, except that it's an interesting discipline to start working on, and get on with the business of asserting the theological truths and the God that we find as we meet him through the scriptures. But I just want to have another little crack at another one of the big myths. I think there are really about four big myths. The big one's Galileo, the next one is Darwin, then there was the so-called Christian, which I don't think he could have been, doctor who invented the forceps but wouldn't let the truth of it out to help women unless they paid an awful lot of money and kept the secret to himself, and also the attack on using anesthetics, especially in childbirth. Those are four things that often Christianity, and there aren't many more actually, it's about those four things that Christians have been accused of as being wicked religionists who anti the ways of human beings, of humanitarianism. That's about the lot. I mean, you can't really find much else. But you'd think there was a whole mass of things with the way that some non-Christians talk as to how Christianity has opposed science and the relief of human suffering and pain. Well,
people point now to Christian opposition to things like
genetic engineering. There's a more up-to-date attacks that some people would use. Yeah, well, they attack Catholic Church and use contraception, don't they? But those sorts of things move into another kind of realm, really, than the what one might say historic attacks that have laid it in the mind of people, and then, because from then onwards, they have a perverted view of the scene. So, this is a little bit of what I wrote in our book. In England, the circle of close supporting naturalist friends around Darwin and Huxley included the Unitarian W.B. Carpenter, 1813 to 1835, who proposed Huxley for his Fellow of the Royal Society, and the Broad Churchman W.H. Flower, 31 to 99. There was the Methodist W.K. Parker, 1823 to 1890, whose lifelong, almost rustic piety was reminiscent of Faraday's, with an exuberant belief in Old Testament miracles. There was J.W. Hulk, 1830-95, a deeply religious Calvinist, who was Huxley's formidable ally. Then in those early years, there was the professor of zoology, Sir George Mivart, 27 to 1900, an evangelical who became a Roman Catholic in 1844 during the revival of Anglo-Catholicism. That was called the Tractarian Movement in Britain. He was a keen Darwinian, and he was almost one of Darwin's inner circle and a close friend of Huxley. His later move to belittling natural selection was a bitter blow to the group. And of course, natural selection does need a bit of belittling, whatever view you have of evolution. It was such a trite approach to try and, giraffes growing longer necks because the leaves were high up in the trees. Well, why didn't the monkeys do it as well? You save them climbing up there, you know, that sort of stuff. It was rather a very poor kind of explanation. In America, the foremost supporter of Darwin was indubitably the botanist Asa Gray, 1810-88, who was the first one outside the English circle to whom Darwin revealed his theory. The Encyclopedia Britannica says of Gray, concerning the publication of his Origin of Species, 1859. Sorry, Gray was one of the first persons whom Darwin kept thoroughly informed concerning the publication of his Origin of Species, 1859. Gray was a devout Christian. However, Livingston states of Gray, his convictions were thoroughly evangelical. He stated that the Nicene Creed encapsulated the heart of his faith. Moore states, a moderate Calvinist and an adherent of the fundamental doctrines of evangelical Christianity. These were all close associates and indeed friends of Darwin. Huxley is the renowned atheist, as the Huxley family still is, as it's gone on into the 20th century. I don't know where it is in the 21st. I mean, it's died out yet. But the main bulk of the adherents to Darwin in his early editions and supported him were those with Christian convictions of varying denominational types, from Calvinists to Methodists and so on. It is quite false, you see, when people make out that Darwin was a wicked man and was just doing it deliberately because somehow or other he hated Christianity and he hated God. That is absolutely untrue. If you go to Down, I don't know today whether it's still there, but it was until a few decades ago. On the grounds of Down, where Darwin lived in his later years and wrote, on the grounds there was a gospel hall, that is a brethren assembly hall. It came about because an evangelist came to the village of Down, when more people lived in villages in those days, conducted a campaign, and this brethren evangelist saw the village drunkard completely transformed. Darwin was so amazed and encouraged by this that he gave the ground for a hall to be built, a mission hall, for the gospel to continue to be preached. There are other stories about Darwin, which are probably true, but one's careful because they nearly always get debunked by the attackers, and this one's gone on for many years being argued for and against. But it seems very likely that his friends in the last months of his life were aware of his devout commitment to Christian truth and his expectancy that belonged to the expectancy of a Christian in Christ. So it is, you know, quite, I think it's, if somebody was alive and you denigrated him like that, you would think it was terrible. But it's worse when you can't answer back. But that's what people have done to try and bolster, they think, the truth of Christianity by debunking and decrying the genuine faith that a man like Darwin had. I mean, how many of you have ever heard before that Darwin had any faith? Yeah, a few of you have. But that's not the way it's put over popularly through much of the Christian world. I've got an article somewhere which was in I can't remember where it is now, but which tells a bit of that story. Anyway, allowing for all that, here's just a list that you'll find perhaps interesting of scientists who were born obviously out of the Christian ethos, thoroughgoing committed scientists, Christians. Did you know that, I've already hinted at it perhaps, that Kepler, who I think is one of the greatest scientists, although he was years ago now, but his breakthroughs were wonderful. Oh, incidentally, when Galileo was told by the church that he was not to do any more writing on the heliocentric Earth, he turned his attention to dynamics, you know, dropping balls out of the Tower of Pisa, which probably is a myth anyway, but that kind of stuff. And he laid the foundation of modern dynamics. So perhaps the church has served us well in taking him out of something which he wasn't so good at and getting him to lay the foundations of modern dynamics. But Kepler, who was contemporary, transformed the old geometrical description of the heavens into a dynamic astronomy. Also founded modern optics, best known for his discovery of the three principles of planetary motion, the first to declare that the other planets resemble the Earth as being material bodies. Kepler was a deeply sincere Lutheran, whose system of astronomy was written with deep symbolism of the divine presence built into it. Blaise Pascal. Pascal laid the foundations of the modern theory of probabilities. Kepler, 1571 to 1630. Pascal, 1623 to 1662. Pascal laid the foundations, probabilities, mathematician. He experienced a profound religious awakening and became a Jansenist who were thrown out of the Catholic Church. But it was the emphasis on his personal experience and his love for Christ. Now, everybody's heard of Boyle's Law, I think. Done half a term at school on physics. Robert Boyle, 1627 to 1691. Boyle was noted for his pioneer experiments in the properties of gases. A devout Protestant, took special interest in promoting the Christian religion abroad, giving money to translate and publish the New Testament. Boyle of Boyle's Law. John Ray, 1627-1705. Ray was a leading 17th century English naturalist and botanist who contributed significantly to progress in taxonomy, putting all the plants in order. He was a sincere Christian who wrote about God in creation. And the name everybody knows, Isaac Newton, 1642-1727. Newton needs no quotation to be recognized as one of the most towering scientific intellects in history. His thinking was profoundly religious, and a personal God was essential to his system. His orthodoxy has been a subject of debate. He was probably more like us in being a bit radical, actually. His orthodoxy, well, I'd like to think so anyway. His orthodoxy has been a subject of debate, but he certainly had a deep belief in the inspiration of Scripture. It's not overly well known that Newton thought that his writings, theological, were far more important than his writings, scientific. Most people disagree with him, even Christians. But that was his commitment to his faith in Christ. George Cuvier, 1769-1832. Cuvier established the sciences of comparative anatomy and paleontology, fossil inquiry. A sincere Protestant, he undoubtedly rediscovered his faith sincerely each time a new period of mourning cast gloom on his existence. That might seem a strange statement for us who try to live as though death is never going to come, but for this period, he runs into the Victorian period, just not quite, 1832 would be. But you know, in the 19th century, death was on hand all the time. You were confronted by death at every turn. Going back one century, even outstanding woman, Susanna Wesley, had 19 children, 9 of which died in childbirth or in the few early years. You have to live with that in those days. Death was a part of life. And each time mourning cast a gloom over existence, he rediscovered his faith. And everybody knows the name of Faraday, 1791 to 1867. One of the greatest scientists of the 19th century, his membership of the Christian sect of Sandemanians was the single most important influence on him and strongly affected the way in which he approached and interpreted nature. The Sandemanians were those who emphasized very strongly the necessity for decision and the place of the will. So much so that Christian experience, in inverted commas, was possibly not so very important to them at all. What was important was the act of the will. It was almost equated to the faith of a relationship, but it was a sincere attempt to rectify the other viewpoints that existed at that time. Asa Gray, I've mentioned, the American, 1810 to 1888, a botanist whose extensive studies of the flora of North America did more than any the work of any other botanist to unify the taxonomy knowledge of plants and of this region. One of the few persons whom Darwin kept fully informed concerning the publication of Origin of Species. Gray was a devout Christian. Louis Pasteur, everybody knows his name, 1822 to 1895. He made scientific contributions among the most varied and valuable in the history of science and industry. He brought about a veritable revolution in 19th century scientific method. Although he was reared and died a Catholic, religious ritual and sectarian doctrine had little attraction for him. He described his own philosophy as one entirely of the heart. Throughout his life he disdained materialists, atheists, freethinkers and positivists. Never doubted the existence of the spiritual realm or of the immortal soul. Lord Kelvin? Name? Ring a bell? He's originally William Thomson, 1824 to 1907. He was foremost among the small group of British scientists who helped to lay the foundations of modern physics. Both Lord Kelvin and the others of the group, including Clerk Maxwell, I'll mention him in a moment, Lord Rayleigh, Stokes, were Bible-believing Christians. James Clerk Maxwell, 1831 to 1879, regarded by modern physicists as the scientists of the 19th century who had the greatest influence on 20th century physics. He's ranked with Sir Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein for the fundamental nature of his contribution. Maxwell had an evangelical conversion while at Cambridge, like many of us, in the early 1850s, not like some of us, and attended a Baptist church in the 1860s. James Clerk Maxwell, outstanding man. Max Planck, you know the name? Should do. He was the originator of quantum theory. He lived 1857 to 1947, 90 years of age. And he, the originator of quantum theory, and revolutionized our understanding of atomic and subatomic processes. With Niels Bohr and people like that, the whole understanding of the nature of matter is completely transformed. These guys, you know, they are the last word in their areas, and today we just accept it, but it's marvellous the way they broke through and thought these things out. Just as Einstein's theory of relativity revolutionized our understanding of space and time, he in particular revolutionized our view of atoms and subatomic processes. Together they constitute the fundamental theories of the 20th century physics. A church warden from 1920 until his death, Planck confessed his belief in an almighty, omniscient God. He didn't actually personify him, but he believed in God in some form personal. Planck said, "Science and religion, although starting from different standpoints, wage a tireless battle against skepticism and dogmatism, against unbelief and superstition, with the goal towards God. Now, all of those were Christians. The last one I've got down in my list that you'll find in my book is Albert Einstein. Died 55. Einstein was one of the most creative intellects in human history. He was a believer in Spinoza's God. Now, that isn't strictly a Christian view, but he believed in a God. Spinoza, with the... coming from the Jewish background, though. Who reveals himself in harmony with what exists. So, the reason why I put him in there was because he spoke often in terms of God. Well, of course, these guys do. They've got enough sense to do so. But one time, the famous quote was, it was a famous one, about perceiving God at work as he was... wasn't thinking God's thoughts after him. That probably goes back to Kepler, but something very similar. The presence of God in his laboratory. He spoke about the God's presence with him in working in his laboratory. Well, there we go. Just a few things there. Summing up again, the Greek view of the universe was a kind of Godfather and Godson, and the universe's son, and model doesn't really lay the foundations for scientific inquiry. The Renaissance view was much more a kind of God, the mechanic, and the universe, the machine, and God having to poke his finger in to keep the machine getting right. The creation view of the Bible, which has become the dynamic operative for Christians who are scientists today, is that God upholds all things, Christ upholds all things by the word of his power. In him all things hold together. That's Hebrews and Colossians. God who upholds all things by the word of his power, and Christ who in whom all things consist, stand together. That view of God is a dynamic view. It's a God who is not, like the Renaissance view, made the universe and thrown it out there and sits and watches it, and something's going wrong, gets a screwdriver and puts something right. Okay. But a God who moment by moment is maintaining it, like the model of a television set. That if God, or the power, if you like, if the plug was pulled out, the picture goes. If God takes his hand away, the universe disappears. He upholds it by the word of his power. He, in him, all of it holds together, consists. Now that view allows that this consistent God might do a miracle. The mechanistic view is very hard for him to do a miracle. The mechanistic view, he can still do it, but it's hard work. He takes his screwdriver, pokes it in, and tightens up a screw without stopping the machine. But most jobs you have to stop the machine, so he wouldn't be able to do much. That's just about a way of getting a miracle. With the Greeks, you see, miracles happen all the time because God's just capriciously doing what he likes. With the mechanistic view of the Renaissance, it's hard to see him do it. And if everything is cause effect, cause effect, cause effect, how does God get in to do it? How does God break into the cause effect 19th century scientific model? Well, going back a couple of centuries, maybe through the pineal gland in the forehead. And that's where God and the soul and God meet together. That's how God gets into the universe. But today, with our dynamic view, if I've got something in my hand there, like that cup, for instance, please, thank you. There's the universe, and there's God upholding it with the word of his power. If he wants to waggle this little finger and change something over here and change water into wine, or waggle it over here and raise somebody from the dead, he can do it. Because he's maintaining it all the time. Okay? If he takes his hand away, it's gone, like the television program disappears if you pull the plug out. Now that is the model which will help us to understand how God is moment by moment maintaining us, and why our very breath is said to be in his hands. The breath of our lips is in his hands. You see the idea? Now, if that is the relationship between God and the universe, it's the one that that scriptures have maintained all the way through. And therefore it's not surprising that out of the Christian commitment line, some of the best scientists have appeared. And still, for that matter, the people who get their names on the television these days are not, generally speaking, the great breakthrough people. One or two, like Mono and people like that, who are atheists, but they're trading on their Christian background, but don't want to admit it. They're treating the universe in a consistent way for no reason at all. But that's, of course, what we've done. And Christians have spawned that idea through the world, so that atheist and Hindu and Muslim scientists can begin to work in the same way. I won't be too hard on the Muslims, because the Muslim philosophy is basically a kind of a Greek philosophy and a bit of biblical philosophy. So, you know, that's not surprising if you might get one or two scientists might have come out of that camp. They're good mathematicians, but not a lot of good not a lot of outstanding breakthrough scientists. But there have been some mathematicians. And indeed in India, amongst Hindus, there have been good mathematicians. It's more theoretical science than technological science. Right. Have I done enough on all that side of things? I just made a note here about the persecution myth. Socrates was put to death in Greece, wasn't he? Great thinker, and he was made to take hemlock. So perhaps it's the Greeks who persecute good thinkers. Bruno and Servetus are the only two scientists who died in the Reformation period. Bruno by the Catholics in Prague, and Servetus by the hands of the Calvinists in Geneva. But otherwise, the scientists of the Reformation period had free access all over Europe, whereas nobody else did, and moved from university to university, lecturing, debating, and so forth, because they were respected by the Christian worldview, whether Catholic or Protestant. But, it's worth, just to be a little bit provocative, that when it comes to persecuting scientists, not only Socrates and Bruno, but Laplace, you know, the great French scientist, Laplace was put to death in the French Revolution with the words, I know it was Robespierre, one of the early ones, but saying that the revolution has no need of scientists, and had him executed. And shouldn't laugh too much, it's tragic. But in Russia, under Stalin, Lysenko was persecuted by the Russians because he couldn't go along with the attack that the Russians had against Mendel's theory at the time, because it didn't fit their views of how evolution would take place. But the Mendelian theory of Lysenko and others was persecuted because it wasn't politically correct. Well, yeah. Is that enough? Yeah, too much, really. Not. So. Let's go back to... Yeah, what should we do to finish, to not take too much more time here? Let's just go back to Genesis for a minute. Another one of the old conundrums that you're likely to come up to is... Often it's said, and you will get this thrown at you as though it's almost proved and irrefutable, that the book of Genesis starts off with two creation stories. Have you heard that? Have you heard it before? Genesis chapter 1, roughly, and Genesis chapter 2, two creation stories. And that those two creation stories, therefore, contradict each other. A few reasons why there are not two versions of creation in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. In chapter 2, a detailed account of the creation of plants and animals is lacking. It's only a passing reference to plants and animals. Let's just have a quick look at it. Genesis 2, verse 4. This is the account of the heavens and earth when they were created. in the day that God, the Lord God, made earth and heaven. Now no shrub of the field was yet in the earth, and no plant of the field had yet sprouted, for the Lord God had not sent rain upon the earth, and there was no man to cultivate the ground, to serve the ground, to look after it. A mist used to rise from the earth, and the water, the surface, the whole ground. Then the Lord God formed man. So whatever else we're getting in those two verses, it is prior to the creation of man, and therefore somewhere between day three, because the ground is mentioned, but day three and day six. There's a description of the situation. And the big point that's coming out is that there's no man there to cultivate the ground. That was the important reflection that's coming here. But it just takes for granted that there will be, or there is, stuff which doesn't come under the terms of shrub of the field or the plant of the field. The shrub of the field or the plant of the field sprouting. In the context of man cultivating the ground, it could well then appear that shrubs and plants that are in view here are to do with cultivation. And since I will make the point that Adam, no matter who his precursors were, or however he came into being, certainly stands on the ground of what today we would call Neolithic man, the New Stone Age man. At the point of which the revolution takes place of agricultural man and animal herding man. It seems as though Neolithic man, that's the New Age, that's the New Stone Age man, that Adam stands as Homo sapiens, or more technically sapiens sapiens, in relationship to us today as completely compatible. And the point of contact is not with some subhuman or hominid, but with, or as argued sometimes, some Cro-Magnon man or some Neanderthal man, but with the full-blooded man as we know him today, which goes back to Neolithic man who starts to cultivate the ground and herd the flocks. That process begins, it seems, round about Adam, at least Adam's descendants, immediate descendants. That's where it seems that Genesis is picking up the story. Does that mean that anything pre-Adam, cultivating man or what, is not really man? Whatever we might think about their skulls and their skeletons. Okay? But that does seem that that's the picture we're being introduced to. So it isn't saying there isn't any vegetation at all. It's saying there isn't any cultivated vegetation. The shrub of the field is not necessarily cultivated vegetation. Because if you look over chapter 3, verse 18, both the thorns and the thistles shall grow for you, and you shall eat of the plant of the field. That's the same word. You'll eat of the plant of the, by the sweat of your brow you eat your bread. So thorns and thistles are outside cultivation because they confuse it. Whereas these plants, the same word, iseb, as we've got down, in verse 5, the second word, no plant, that word there, no plant of the field. Could it be, it's only a suggestion, not being dogmatic, could it be that in verse 5 of chapter 2, no seer of the field was yet in the earth? That's referring to the thorns and the thistles, and the plant of the fields to the cultivated crop, which then when they come up, the one word is the same, but the other word is a different one. In verse 18, the thorns and thistles shall grow up for you, and you shall eat of the iseb, the plant of the field. So perhaps iseb is the same in both verses, But the thorns and the thistles take the place of the shia, the shrub of the field, in verse 5. If that's the case, then what we've got is that this is prior to the fall, and the definition for a farmer of crops from the sweat of his brow, and thorns and thistles, which are a part of why his brow sweats, to keep them out of the cultivated areas, are the change that's taken place. Not that they are new things, that suddenly thorns and thistles have appeared, but they were in the wrong place. They're in the middle of the field of cereals, or whatever crops he's trying to grow to make his bread. So whatever else, the existence of such is not necessarily at point verse 5, they're just there. So nothing really is said about vegetation. And then when you get to verse 17, from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, you may eat of all the other trees, rather, verse 16. So there's certainly a few trees that are being put there. Verse 18, the animals are brought to him. So the animals have just come into existence. So it's not a creation story at all, because these things are just there and they're popping up. And you can't have a creation story if the animals and all and the vegetation are already in existence, which is the point I'm trying to make in great long rigmaroles. Okay. Secondly, that's point one. Chapter 2, new material is presented concerning a garden in the limited geographical area of Eden. The first chapter is speaking about the whole globe, the whole of the earth. Genesis is talking about a little bit of the earth in the area of Eden, and there God planted a garden. Doesn't say nothing else had ever been planted. We saw that's probably not likely from the way we read verse 5. Certainly doesn't mean to say that there weren't any animals, and if there are animals, they must have been eating something, so there must have been vegetation. But chapter 2, again, is not the slightest bit interested in a creation story. It's talking about a garden story. It's God as the gardener. Thirdly, nothing is said in the so-called creation story of chapter 2 about the sun, the moon and the stars. What kind of a creation story is it that never bothers to tell you about the sun? And the night time coming, where's the sun gone? Everybody knows the sun's there. Well, there's the moon. Oh, yeah, seen that. And the star. Oh, it's the stars. Nothing said about the creation of the sun and the moon and the stars. How can you call it a creation story? Everything is missing. Vegetation is already there. Animals are already there. The sun, moon and stars are not even mentioned. In Genesis 2, nothing is said concerning the rest of the universe outside Eden and its creation, nor the animals and their creation in this area. It just says, something's already in existence and I'm going to plant a garden in it. Again, it's a very strange story for the creation of the earth. What's God planting the garden in? There's nothing to plant it in. But all this is variously just ignored. And it's supposed to be a second creation story, according to even some footnotes in books tell you. In Bibles, don't they? They are not two creation stories. Let's get it into our system. The first is a creation story. The second is a story of God's relationship with man, placed in a garden. It's focused and located. The words used in Genesis 2:5, the plant of the field and the herb of the field, are limited and specific in their meaning and don't refer to vegetation in general, as I was just trying to argue through for you. So those are reasons why I would suggest it is very unhelpful to talk about two creation stories. The first story shows us man as the Homo sapiens as the climax of the story, like the pinnacle or the apex of God's creative work. The second story shows us man as the center and the focus in the middle of the universe that he's made. That is, all is in a sense swinging around him. One, he's the apex of God's creation. Two, the second story shows him as the center point, the focus around which everything is moving. And those two viewpoints put together begin to give us a more comprehensive view of creation. Long way to go yet. We'll have to spend another day or two. But here is a picture that my son did for me from Genesis chapter 1. There are three commands in Genesis 1. The first command is, fill up the earth and multiply. That's a command. Second command is, in Genesis chapter 1, have dominion over the animals and subdue the earth. Put the two together, sex, you need a bit of sex to fill up the earth. Rather difficult otherwise. And aggression, you need a bit of aggression to subdue the animals, have dominion over the animals, subdue the earth. Make use of the earth, dig its gold and precious stones out of it, and so on, chapter 2. So Genesis chapter 1, on the first page of the Bible, in this glorious statement of God creating the earth, forming it and filling it, breaching the climax, the apex of his creation in the creation of human being. Human being with a complex definition, male and female, created he them, and he gave them, not him, gave them the command to fill up the earth, because you couldn't do it by yourself. And gave them the command to have dominion and subdue it, because you can't do it by yourself. Oh, but we can. Both things are wrong. When people say, for instance, homosexuality isn't condemned in the begin creation, it's not condemned, it's just not even contemplated. The purpose of sex is to fill up the earth, and you do it together. The purpose of aggression is to have dominion over the earth and develop and get out its best potential, subdue it, bring it into order. And you do it together. But mankind has tried to govern the earth and rule the earth without doing it together with woman. Written with all the debates start about whether the Bible teaches about women doing this or doing that, on the very first page in paradise itself, the declaration is made, this is a do it together job, not a do it alone. And it's only when men and women learn to retain sex in its proper context together, and not man to man, homosexuality, by the fact that it isn't there, is in a sense proscribed, because the purpose of anything is the definition ultimately of it. I have been given sex for procreation and for man-woman relationship, male and female, created them, and said to them, fill up the earth. And says to man and woman together, have dominion, have authority over it. But we find it too difficult for men and women to work together. It's not easy. But men and women working together and exerting authority together is the way in which the earth was meant to be ordered, subdued, have dominion, so that man could fulfill his purpose. So sex and aggression, that's a bit of Freud, isn't it? The only problem with Freud is he's a bit late on the scene, sex and aggression, end of the 19th century, 20th century, whereas the Bible had it all the time. That's the chaos that sex and aggression, let's make it a beetle with an engine in the back, you know, the little beetle, driving the vehicle. We've been put in the driving seat for the purpose of, when the lights are red, we stop. When we signal to go right, we turn right. When we signal to go left, we turn left, etc., etc. And using sex and aggression as the brake and as the accelerator properly, the drive, the force of the engine, because those are the two libido powers, those are the two forces in human beings. I don't mean sex simply in sexual activity. Sex also breaks into all sorts of sublimations of art and creativity and intuitive and aggression into bringing order and development and so on. These are just the drives that are in the human being. But if we don't take any notice of the traffic lights, if we signal right and turn left, if we don't occasionally adjust brake and accelerator, of course we run through life causing masses of chaos. And of course that is what sin is. It's letting those two commands, come two libido forces, come two drives, come Freud, but later on the scene, Bible, the drive of the human being, not properly governed, brings chaos not only to others but to ourselves. It destroys us in the end. That is why they are two such powerful forces. Remembering that aggression in a more sophisticated form is called money, isn't it? Because money is you get your will done. Money is how you get your will done in life. Sex and aggression, the true great drives, you will find, just open up the door to think in terms of money as well. It's how you get your will done, it's aggression. You put those two things together, you will find the root virtually of all sin. Sin is found there. Now, we know, of course, that behind those two is pride. But that's just rebellion. That is just misusing the highway code. That is just not listening to the way that God wanted the vehicle to be driven. And that's where we start the story in Genesis 1 and 2 put together, and Genesis 3 comes in and the chaos begins. Whatever else we think about the Bible and its relationship, as I've spent a lot of time this morning to science and other things, in the final analysis is the most profound and yet understandable analysis of the human being and the human being's predicament and problem that you could find anywhere. It is not a fanciful story of snakes having their legs knocked off or of pinching apples, which it says nothing about apples in the Bible, as you know. This is a profound analysis of the human being's relationship to God, to himself, to the sexes, to the universe, and to sin itself, and the enemy, and spiritual powers. It's the most profound introduction of you could find in any philosophical or theological treatise, but it's one which all ages, God's done a magnificent job, all centuries, and in all cultures, it's understandable. And so the Lord helps us to grasp what life's about and start to function, not as the clevers, but as ordinary human beings. A bunch of peasants as we are, by the look of us. Okay, shall we leave it there? Got the idea?